Hello, my name is Jennifer Moorman, and I'm a scholar of cinema and media studies and gender and sexuality studies. And I'm going to be providing some analytical commentary about Existenz. I want to start off by talking about the title. Now, I haven't seen David Cronenberg specifically acknowledge it anywhere, but it seems to be a reference to Reason and Existenz, which is the title of a translation of five existentialist lectures delivered by Karl Jaspers in 1935, touching on ideas such as the communicability of truth and the limits of rational thought. Existentialism is definitely a major theme of the film, and Cronenberg does acknowledge that in interviews, so I'll get into it more as the film goes on, but for now, to really oversimplify, existentialism refers to a branch of philosophy that emphasizes individualism and emphasizes individuals as free and responsible agents who determine their own fates through acts of will. In interviews, Cronenberg has also said that one of the inspirations for this story about a game designer who's targeted by ideological assassins came from an interview he had conducted with the author Salman Rushdie. At the time, Rushdie had been subject to several assassination attempts and death threats by people with ideological objections to his fourth novel, The Satanic Verses. And this struck Cronenberg as a clash of realities. He says that, from Rushdie's point of view, in the Western literary tradition of freedom of expression, he'd done absolutely nothing wrong. But from the opposing point of view, he had committed blasphemy and therefore deserved to die. And basically that got Cronenberg thinking about the idea that whichever reality you happen to be living in makes perfect sense to you, but they're irreconcilable, and when they come together, they clash. So on one level, we can see how Rushdie's experience might be reflected in the assassination plotlines, but also the strange interbleedings of other realities that interfere with Allegra's reality in the film were inspired by what happened to Rushdie in a more metaphorical sense. This was the first film since Videodrome in 1983 that Cronenberg both wrote and directed. In interviews at the time, he said that he wasn't consciously thinking of Videodrome when he wrote Existenz and doesn't consider this film to be tackling the same themes necessarily, though certainly many critics have made the connection between them. Both films are looking at the ways that technology impacts our lives, the ways that we, in a sense, become one with and thereby lose ourselves to media technologies in particular.
Existenz, written like this, one word, small e.
This film would also be Cronenberg's last true quote-unquote body horror movie for 23 years until Crimes of the Future was released in 2022. He's said in interviews that he doesn't really consider any of his films to be horror. He sees horror as the study of fear and doesn't believe that's what he's doing in his work. He considers this one in particular to be primarily a science fiction film, but certainly most of his earlier movies, including Shivers, Rabid, The Brood, Scanners, Videodrome, Dead Ringers, and The Fly, have been marketed and received as horror movies. And in any case, we can see this film as occupying a kind of nexus between the body horror of these earlier films and the more psychological dramas that would come later, such as Spider, Eastern Promises, and A History of Violence. Now, this is where we're really first introduced to our game designer, Allegra. And in one of her first lines of dialogue, we're going to be introduced to one of the film's major themes.
People are programmed to accept so little, but the possibilities are so great. Existenz is not just a game. It's an entirely new game system. And it involves a whole lot of new toys, which you're gonna be the first to try out. So
I'll be talking more about this as the film goes on, but for now I'll say that this is a movie that's all about the ways that we as individuals are constrained by systems and industries programmed to accept so little from them, and also about questioning the nature of reality, what is real and what is just a game or just a movie.
Hold it! Not so fast.
Oh, geez, right.
Here I think we get a glimpse of the illusion of choice. People seem to be volunteering to play this game, but in retrospect, after having seen the film all the way through, we know that the game's already being played by 12 people.
Yes.
And here we have our incel character, and as with any film, the technologies may feel very dated, but I think this film gets around that by making the technologies so metaphorical. It's not trying to show us a literal vision of the future. And again, we're already inside the game here, so dated tech could just be part of the game's diegesis.
I know it's kind of obsolete, even though I couldn't afford the Antenna 15 upgrade.
At $31 million Canadian dollars, Existenz was the most expensive Canadian feature made since Shadow of the Wolf. But at the time, Cronenberg spoke in interviews about how, although thematically the film is about very high-tech biotechnologies, the film's production process was actually pretty low-tech. There's very minimal use of CGI. It's mostly advanced puppetry and mold making, as we'll see here with the game pods. Apparently, only a few shots include effects that are entirely computer generated. For example, the bone gun that we're about to see really worked. Cronenberg says in interviews that it was made from bone and gristle and really had to be able to fire teeth.
Now, I'm warning you, it's going to be a wild ride. But don't panic.
From the very beginning, this film disorients us. There are many clues that we're already inside the game here in this opening sequence, and even more so in the sequences that are about to follow. Many details are surreal, hyper-real, or anti-realist. The game unit is immediately disturbing, fleshy, pulsating, umbilical. It makes uncanny noises like some kind of sentient alien creature. And the bone gun takes this sort of body horror technology to another level. Most of us are used to the idea of technologies being embedded within bodies, for instance, pacemakers or metal rods used for spinal fusions or to repair broken bones. But this idea of making technologies out of flesh and bone feels more alien, or maybe more primitive. The technology feels simultaneously advanced and primitive, almost like we could draw a direct line between the ape person throwing a bone weapon up into the sky in an unspecified prehistoric world at the beginning of 2001 A Space Odyssey, and this bone gun in an unspecified future world. When this guy yells death to the demoness Allegra Geller in just a second, it hits differently in a post-Gamergate world. It's almost like the film predicts those kinds of personal attacks against women in gaming spaces. But long before Gamergate brought attention to the marginalization of women in video games, women had been experiencing all kinds of sexism in the industry. Women simply weren't recognized as game consumers, so when they did manage to become game developers, they were often pigeonholed and only given opportunities to design female-oriented content. One example is Sherry Grainer Ray, who created a CD-ROM game called Mackenzie & Co., where the goal was to get a prom date. It's an interesting contrast to Allegra Geller here, who's lauded, respected, and feared, and creates games that aren't gendered in any discernible way. I think the performances here may come off as simply bad, but I'd argue it's one of the ways that the film intentionally feels off from the very beginning. Once you know that we're already in the game, the stiltedness of these performances makes more sense. Some critics at the time suggested that we could think of this as a road movie, as well as a sci-fi drama, and that journey is about to begin. I also think this is some intriguing casting. Jennifer Jason Leigh is 10 years older than her co-star Jude Law. At the time, they were 37 and 27, respectively. So their relationship involves a reversal of gender norms. The vast majority of the time, of course, if there's a notable age difference between leads, we'll see an older man with a younger woman. But Jennifer Jason Leigh isn't just a decade older than he is. She's also famous for playing women whose sexuality is marked as deviant or dangerous. For instance, in Single White Female, Sister Sister, Dolores Claiborne, and Washington Square. Intentionally or otherwise, I think she's bringing echoes of those previous roles with her into this one.
Death to Allegra Geller.
I'd like to hear someone with a... Overall, I think that this depiction of her is playing into gendered stereotypes in some ways, and in others, it's calling attention to them. In this scene, for instance, she's very dominant, and Pikul, by contrast, seems clueless and ineffectual. But she's also pretty unlikable. We'll see she lashes out at him, and while she might be in the right in many cases, for instance, here we could assume she's correct that he shouldn't be answering his phone, but the way that she communicates these things is presumptuous and often rude.
What? Hey!
This man doesn't actually owe her anything after all. At this point, he doesn't even know her. In this moment, she claims to have thought he was hired by her security guard, so that could excuse how she was treating him up until this moment. But she really doesn't behave any differently. If anything, she becomes bossier once she learns that he's actually just a marketing trainee, or, as she puts it derisively, a PR nerd.
Fucking hell. I'm marked for death, and they send me on the road, the PR nerd.
Marked for death. Marked for death. Oh, jeez.
Okay. Don't sweat it, Pico. Don't sweat it. I'm gonna handle it. And, right now, we need to stop.
Do why?
So again, he's, kind of saving her life here. And... he seems to have taken this on simply because his employer said so.
Come on, if you're gonna do it, do it.
Okay.
And like a punchline to a joke, the cut reveals that in this intimate moment, he will penetrate her only with a knife. In contemporary interviews, Cronenberg talked about how there's actually no sex directly depicted in this film. Sex appears exclusively as innuendo and metaphor. There is a later scene in which these two begin to have sex, but it's cut short before they do more than make out. So the sexual energy is instead sublimated into their interactions with the game pods. Those innuendos really start popping up here in the car with this reference to an intimate moment. And I think it's worth pointing out that it's no coincidence that the intimate moment turns out to involve a kind of violence. This is by no means the last time that the film will equate sex with violence or death, and also with tools or technologies. Cronenberg talks about what we see in this film as a kind of metaphorical or neo-sex involving the gaming apparatus. And he connects it to the idea of body modification, which he sees as an example of the ways that we as humans have never accepted our bodies or our environment as is. Body modification can serve a medical purpose, of course, but it can also serve a variety of social, cultural, political, sexual, and/or cosmetic purposes. This particular modification, if we want to call it that, that we've been watching, is purely medical. He's trying to dig out the bullet, which turns out to be a tooth. But of course, the film's most notable example of body modification will be the bioports, which are notoriously sexualized, but their primary function is more utilitarian. So So you'll notice here when we get inside that the takeout food they've got comes from Perky Pat's, which is a direct reference to Philip K. Dick's book, The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch. This film has frequently been compared to Total Recall, which was adapted from the Dick novella We Can Remember It For You Wholesale. It's interesting that Cronenberg would include allusions like this because of his notoriously troubled involvement with the pre-production of Total Recall. There's an entire chapter in David Hughes' book, Tales from Development Hell, about Cronenberg's years spent writing 12 scripts of Total Recall for Dino De Laurentiis. Cronenberg walked away from the project when his co-writer, Ronald Shusett, insisted that they shouldn't be so faithful to Dick's original text and should instead make something more like Raiders of the Lost Ark Goes to Mars. Ironically, Dimension Films, the distributor of Existenz, ended up buying the sequel rights for Total Recall. But comparisons between this film and Total Recall don't seem to displease Cronenberg. He describes himself in interviews as a big fan of Philip K. Dick and acknowledges that Total Recall in some ways prefigures the themes of this film.
Hey, what are you doing?
This was a cultural moment when VR and augmented reality were very hot in general. The theme of virtual reality was explored relentlessly in 90s sci-fi, starting with Lawnmower Man in 1992, followed in the mid-90s by Strange Days, Brain Scan, and VR5, and peaking in 1999 with the simultaneous release of Existenz, The 13th Floor, The Matrix, and Open Your Eyes.
I've been dying to play.
But after 1999, it's as if we realized that telepresent VR was actually decades away from fruition, and these existential crises about the threat of being unable to distinguish reality from VR no longer felt as relevant. Instead, we turned our anxiety to the internet and smartphones and now AI, and that's where most of the more recent tech horror has been focused.
It's too freaky, it makes my skin crawl.
They just pop your spine with a little hydro gun.
And there we have another innuendo, of course. The pause before surgically really drives the point home, I think. This kind of joke functions as self-reflexivity. I think the film's really calling attention to itself, and that self-reflexivity fits within the larger themes of the film.
You can't seriously want to play games now.
We shouldn't be able to fully escape into the film's narrative any more than the realists in the diegesis think that people should escape into the virtual reality games.
My baby hair took a huge hit in the church, Michael.
Jude Law's line delivery is similarly self-reflexive in that his accent goes in and out. Most of the time he sounds like he's doing an American accent pretty badly, I think, but like the wooden acting that we saw in the opening sequence, I think this could be intentional. Once we learn that they're already in the game, we recognize that he's in fact an actor playing the role of a character playing the role of a different character.
Right now.
Allegra consistently anthropomorphizes the game pod, as she does here. In so doing, she speaks of it in a way that sometimes feels maternal, other times erotic, and oftentimes an unsettling mix of the two. She talks about the pod as if it's actually alive. She's concerned that it is injured and possibly in pain. So the lines between organic and inorganic, human and technology, are blurred. So she's convincing him to get a bioport installed despite his fear of being penetrated surgically. And that leads to this line.
Let's do it now. Let me see. To get an illegal unregistered bioport installed at about midnight. We just drive up to your local country gas station, right?
Which leads us into another cut as punchline. In this case, I think it serves as another indication that we're already in the game. The film is constantly knocking us off balance like this. His statement is strange. Why on earth would they go to a gas station for that? And yet they do. It's as if he's spoken it into existence, which shouldn't be possible in the world of our shared reality. This kind of cinematic manipulation of time and space is also used in video game design, and in combination with the other strange elements of the diegesis, the cut feels uncanny. And here is where we first meet Gas, one of Willem Dafoe's trademark pansexual characters, interested in anything and everything, similar to roles he's played in Autofocus, The Loveless, and Streets of Fire. The name Gas certainly adds to the feeling that there is something very off about this world. And that's only further heightened as he realizes who she is here and falls to his knees and prostrates himself before her. When he says that she's changed his life, it's hard to believe it.
Before it was changed by Allegra Geller.
I operated a gas station.
You still operate a gas station, don't you?
Only on the most pathetic level of reality.
Geller's work liberated.
Pickle is skeptical here. After all, a gas station attendant is a job that's devalued in the real world as menial labor. This idea that now he only does that on the most pathetic level of reality really ties into the film's critique of using entertainment technologies as vehicles for escapism, and also into the theme of the subjective nature of reality. But importantly, it also ties these ideas to the issue of labor. After all, under capitalism, most of us spend most of our waking lives laboring, first in school and later in the workforce. And this is one of the primary reasons we seek to escape into other realities. As film theorists like Krakauer, Adorno, and Horkheimer have argued, film and other entertainment media keep us complacent. We watch movies or play video games or scroll through social media feeds as a way to unwind and recharge so that we can get up the next day to do it all over again. Whereas without these tools of escapism, we might be forced to reckon with our own exploitation.
Step into my office.
This is a callback to a previous line where he'd said, God, the artist, the mechanic, calling attention to the constructed nature of reality at the same time as the film acknowledges its own overt construction. And again, I think it's making an interesting statement about labor, this time by collapsing the conventional distinctions between art as cultural production and other forms of commodity production. An artist with a god complex can be knocked down a peg if he's compared to a mechanic. This is some strange behavior from Allegra that we're witnessing. Since we don't know yet, though we may suspect that they're already in the game, it's not at all clear what she's doing or why she's smiling about it in this way. She seems to be taking it all in. And this is the first time we see this little mutated lizard creature, which suggests that maybe the game universe is bleeding into the real world. Personally, when I first watched the film, this is when I really began to suspect that they were already in the game. At this point, though, it's still entirely plausible that the lizard could just be a normal aspect of the dystopian future. But later, when Pykele sees it too, it becomes clear that it's as alien to him as it is to us. But she still brushes it off as a sign of the times. Only in retrospect, after Allegra kills Pykele near the end of the film, and their counterparts in what's maybe the real world exit the game world, is it confirmed that the lizard has in fact been just a little NPC or non-player character in this game that our characters have already been inside of all along. As I mentioned earlier, most of the effects are practical, but this shot of the creature is one of only a few that's entirely computer generated. And this is where the film starts to get rapey, we might say.
What's going on, Gas?
Interestingly, you know, when she's about to try to convince him to get the bioport installed. She's going to stand on a tire in order to raise herself to his physical level, even though it seems unnecessary. She's clearly the one calling the shots, regardless.
This is it, you see? This is the cage of your own making, which keeps you trapped and pacing about in the smallest possible space forever. Break out of your cage.
So, Allegra coerces Pikul into getting the bioport, despite his fear of being penetrated, by telling him that his fear is a cage of his own making. And Gas is the one who's about to penetrate Pikul from behind, kicking the polymorphous perversity that characterizes every interaction with the game pod into high gear. It's also notable that he's given an epidural, just like when you have a baby, as Gas explains, for those who might have missed the point.
What's going on? I can't move my legs.
Quite clever for the bulk of the narrative to feature a strong woman as a game designer coercing a male sidekick into doing things she wants him to do, and for the sexual assaults to function purely on the level of metaphor. I think this is all pretty uncomfortable, but if we imagine the gender roles reversed here, it would be even more uncomfortable and in a bad way. As it is, it's uncomfortable mostly in a good way, in the sense that it denaturalizes gender roles and encourages us to question our own assumptions about gender and power. So, continuing the gender-reversed coercive sex metaphor, she insists on porting into him immediately after the procedure, again, despite his protests. He specifically balks because he's paralyzed and therefore presumably extra vulnerable. And she's very manipulative, saying, "You wanted to play my game, didn't you?" And it reminds me of scenes from other films, and unfortunately from people's realities, in which a man might say some version of, "But I thought you liked me," to convince a woman to have sex with him. And in case we didn't pick up on that, she remarks that Newports are sometimes a bit tight while lubing up his new orifice.
They open right.
The actual insertion, though, is not particularly violent, and nor is it erotic. Although the metaphor is sexual, I think for most viewers at least, it isn't sexy. This is also an interesting moment. He's scared that the bioport as an open orifice will get infected, and she opens her mouth to remind him that all of us already have several open orifices that aren't constantly getting infected. But this strikes me as disingenuous. The bioport is essentially a wound, not a congenital feature of our bodies. But I think at the same time, there's a useful idea in there about breaking down the binary between natural and artificial, human and technology. And now, much like a sleazy guy who comes too quickly and blames his partner for it, she gets angry, saying, "You blew my pod," which maybe not coincidentally sounds like, "I blew my wad." It turns out, of course, that it's not his fault. As we will soon see, Gas has intentionally installed a bad port in order to destroy the game system and collect a bounty. So here again, she can be rather unlikable, even beyond the fact that she's blaming him for something that was entirely outside of his control, something I might add that was her own idea and which she forced upon him. It also just seems irrational and unfair for her to expect him to put up with any of this. She's the one who needs his help, and she's now explaining that this is the only copy of a game system that cost $38 million to develop, not including marketing costs. But why should it matter to him, or to us, if some corporation loses an amount of money, which is incidentally pretty close to the $31 million figure in Canadian dollars, that was the budget for this film, or if some game designer loses her product when people and animals and the planet are suffering and dying? So how has she managed to convince this stranger to modify his body in ways that terrify him, purely for the sake of trying to fix a game pod? Basically, it's feeling more and more like a dream, where choices and actions are not necessarily motivated by conventional behavioral or narrative logic. In any case, we could read this as just another misogynistic depiction of a woman in power as inherently bitchy and hysterical, or we could see it as intentionally playing into those expectations, only to subvert them, especially once we come to see how the film will pull the proverbial rug out from under us every time we feel like we're starting to get a handle on what's happening.
She changed your
life. The film's self-reflexivity really reaches an apex here as she tries to convince Gas that he's being naive if he assumes that whoever has a bounty put out on her head will really pay up after he kills her.
Whatever it is. I think I just did that, didn't I?
Can you kill me, Gas? Can you kill a person? Can you do that? Hide my body. Contact the crazies. Trust them to pay up. And over my now decaying.
The film is continually reminding us of the ways that movies and other media technologies teach us how to be ourselves. They show us what it means to be human, a man, a woman, a laborer. When he replies here, "I like your script, I want to be in it," we're asked to examine our own complicity in media's manipulation of us. And with this decisive choice that Paykel made to kill a man to save Allegra's life, their bond begins to build and deepen. Earlier, she had told Paykel, "Of course, without another player, you're only a tourist," suggesting that wandering through life without human connection is not really living. Heterosexual coupling provides a sense of closure for a majority of Hollywood and Hollywood-style films across most genres. Even action movies like Die Hard often end up being about a hero getting a girl in some sense. So we might imagine at this point that this narrative will similarly build to a love connection, but that's one thing I appreciate about Cronenberg films. They may be a lot of things, but heteronormative typically isn't one of them. Also, I'm obsessed with her ski boot purse. I don't have anything particularly smart to say about it, but it's just peak millennium cyberpunk nonsense. And her styling in general is interesting. Her hair is vaguely alt-futuristic, like the purse, but the rest of her outfit and her makeup are pretty no-nonsense business casual, which fits squarely within the drab color palette of the entire film, with interior shots dominated by grays and browns. And here's that mutated lizard again, and Paykel definitely doesn't know what to make of it, whereas she's typically unfazed. It's a bit confusing, perhaps intentionally so, that he's so much less familiar with the world that they live in. So this is, you know, strange. Why wouldn't he know that? It's as if he has amnesia or something. So again, another hint that they're already in the game. And this is where we're introduced to Ian Holm's character, Kiri Vinegar. He's speaking with a vaguely Eastern European and I think intentionally fake-sounding accent. I'm convinced that the bad accents are supposed to be additional hints that this world isn't as it seems, especially since she later complains to Paykel about the bad accent of one of the NPCs. For her, it reveals the apparatus, as it were. The bad character design takes her out of the game. I think the bad accents are similarly supposed to reveal the movie's apparatus to us throughout.
I'm so pleased.
Cronenberg has said in interviews that he wasn't intentionally returning to the themes of Videodrome with this film, but consciously or not, Existenz really feels like its spiritual sequel. Of course, both films are about the subjective nature of reality, the dangers of media culture taking over our lives, and more idiosyncratically about fleshy media technologies that need to be directly inserted into the human body to be played. But there are a lot of less obvious connections as well. Both films are actually pretty messy and contradictory in terms of their politics, but in ways that I think are interesting and productive. Both explore the idea of being programmed to behave in certain ways by the media we consume. And I think most relevant at this point in the narrative, in both films we feel uneasy as the protagonist encounters a series of people who seem vaguely untrustworthy. It turns out that most of them are indeed manipulating the protagonists while claiming to be trying to help them. And Vinegar here is no exception. The protagonists have no choice but to go along with it because they're metaphorically lost at sea.
And make sure I don't lose everything I have in here.
You bet.
I don't know whether this allusion is intentional because Cronenberg has disavowed connections between this film and Alien in various interviews as well, but I think there is a remarkable similarity between this scene in which Ian Holm's scientist character operates on a creature that creepily evokes human reproductive organs and the scene in Alien in which Ian Holm's medical officer character performs a necropsy on a creature that creepily evokes human genitals. And to me, that allusion is another hint that this character, and indeed this entire story, is not as it seems. We eventually learn in Alien that his character is an android, and he becomes the film's primary antagonist, aside from the titular alien. I think Holm carries that character history with him into this scene and encourages us not to trust his character's motivations. In this film, penetration is depicted as horrifying, or at the very least, alien and uncomfortable. The game pod looks like a uterus, and they call the implement of penetration an umbicord. So, you know, these internal organs are, you know, something that represents them is outside of the body and then penetrating into another body, which is all very strange and uncomfortable. I think similar to some of the things that Alien does with its notoriously kind of like phallic and vaginal looking creatures, we could say that this film is denaturalizing an aspect of gender norms, making it strange in order to get us to see the world we actually live in with fresh eyes. So just another way that the film encourages us to question reality.
Get that nasty bioport after you put nice fresh one in there.
Oh, shh. It hurts. I think it's infected.
No, it's not infected.
So saying that the port is excited and wants action while lubing up a finger with saliva and penetrating, this port anus brings us back into sexual assault territory. You know, he's not sure that he wants the action, he says, but he's easily coerced as she asks him again if he's friendly. She says this to him repeatedly. And as with Videodrome, there's a deep discomfort at the idea of men's bodies, in particular being penetrable, therefore vulnerable. Here we get a port anus instead of a stomach vagina. But here the film is going to gesture toward a larger political point.
This thing will run off my body's energy?
That's how they work.
See? You're humming along already. Okay, existence, only from antenna. Here we go.
It's very striking to me that he assumes right off the bat, even though she's been asking if he's friendly, that they will be competing, and that therefore he'd be at a disadvantage. To me, this evokes the idea of a system being rigged, which is how we might describe capitalism. It's a system based entirely on competition for resources, and the winners are those who hoard the most. So we're trained from a young age to see others as competitors rather than as comrades or compatriots. And anyone who stops to think about it might see that the people who benefit most from that competition are the ones who are already hoarding so many of the resources. So the average participant doesn't really have a chance. Her reply feels like an empty deflection. Could he beat the guy that invented poker? Probably not. She's attempting to downplay the inherent advantages that, within the context of the game world, she's effectively born into. And this is exactly how cultural theorists of film like Adorno, Horkheimer, and Krakauer describe the role of media in our lives. It misdirects, distracts, and keeps us complacent so that we don't have the time or the energy to look around and think about the power we could have if we all work together instead of competing with each other.
Interlacing from place to place?
Well, depends on the style of game.
And now we have finally entered the game within a game. This entire scene is very self-reflexive. He says, "I feel just like me," again prompting us to consider how, in this media-saturated moment in time, we come to self-understanding through the things we watch and read and the games we play. And this film is asking us to think about, what are the borders of the self? At what point am I no longer me? What does it actually mean to be me? Unless we feel tempted to think of the game as an entirely separate medium from cinema, the film again reminds us that it's not. He asks if the transition is always this smooth, and she says it depends on the game. Just like in a movie, you can get jagged, brutal cuts, slow fades. And she also says things like, you have to play the game to find out why you're playing the game, which feels like it could be the subtitle or tagline for, like, Existentialism for Dummies.
Look at this. Can this be the future too? Ever see anything like this before?
These are delicate.
And here we get another character with a notably bad accent. But in this case, it's coupled with strange behavior that suggests we've got an NPC on our hands. We can see in this scene that the game within a game version of Paykel, let's call him Paykel 2.0, is more assertive and decisive than the version of him we'd seen before. Meanwhile, she's wearing a notably sexier outfit and keeps perching provocatively on various objects. But there's a definite continuity between their characters in the earlier scenes and their characters in the game within the game. Philip Lopate for Film Comment says that there is a cinema of character, as in the films of Eric Rohmer, and a cinema of visual dream, as with David Lynch's filmography. And at its best, Cronenberg's work embodies a bit of both. What makes this film so intriguing for him is that we are invited to follow a core of self in the two main leads, a continuity of personality that we can imagine we still see in and around the character transformations brought on by the game. So even at his most violent, Paykel 2.0 still seems a little nerdy, and Allegra remains easily irritated by her partner's difficulty with adapting to the game.
Look at him.
This definitely reflects a more modernist or existentialist understanding of the self as being coherent and kind of a core of our being that maintains some kind of continuity throughout our lives. This is in contrast, at least in terms of theoretical frameworks, to the film's focus on the subjective nature of reality and the multiplicity of truths rather than a singular truth with a capital T, which is an idea that's very symptomatic of postmodernity. Postmodernists argue that, like reality, the idea of a coherent self is an illusion. This film seems to stop short of that kind of philosophical speculation. But even so, Paykel 2.0 immediately calls into question whether this is really him. He says that he's spoken without volition in this scene. And here we learn that within the game, the characters that they're playing will sometimes take over their bodies.
I assume that you both have had these industry standard bioports that you mentioned installed.
Yes, of course, we both have bioports. We do, don't we?
Assumed we did. In the game, of course, we might not.
We better check.
So they talk in this sequence about the idea that there are things that need to be said in order to advance the plot or heighten the emotions of the next sequence, reminding us that what we see in cinema is never reality. It's always a construct. Existentialists like Heidegger suggest that our choices and therefore our free will are constrained. We're often thrust into situations that are beyond our control, and even our possibilities for responding to them are limited by various systems and social norms and individual abilities. As in the game, there are scripts that must be followed, things that we must do to advance, to keep ourselves alive and function in a society.
I assume that Nader is our entry point into the game.
Yeah, kind of disappointing.
Nader?
Yeah, he's not a very well-drawn character. His dialogue was just so-so. His accent.
So here she calls attention to the bad accent, which I think is self-reflexive because we've been getting a lot of bad accents again, but this is the first one we've encountered in the game within the game. There's so many shots in this film of lubing up and fingering those anal ports.
Bioport.
Cronenberg, again, refers to this as neo-sex and questions whether we'd want to actually call it sex. He admits in an interview that it's obviously inducing some kind of pleasure the way sex does, but what is it?
The whole pod.
I'm not sure, but I think he really stands alone in being able to create non-normative sexual imagery that is so simultaneously erotic and disturbing. And again, in a reversal of gender norms, we mostly see her fingering him. We almost never actually see him fingering her port or inserting the game pod's umbilical cord. Normally, women's bodies are the source of visual pleasure in cinema. The camera tends to linger on them rather than on men's bodies, especially during sex scenes. Until now, that is, when he's about to stick his tongue in her port. Interestingly, at that point, she's the one who reacts as though she's been assaulted. And fair enough, she had consented to having the port inserted, but not to pseudo-analingus. He gets defensive immediately, saying it wasn't me, it was my game character. And this really evokes the kind of justification an abuser might use in the real world. That wasn't really me. But it also prompts us once again to reflect on the roles that we play and the ways that the stories we tell about ourselves can delude, enable, or constrain us. And after all, she's into it.
The characters are obviously supposed to jump on each other. It was probably an pathetically mechanical attempt to heighten the emotional tension of the next.
So, ironically, here sex is suggested purely to move the plot forward, whereas sex scenes in cinema have always been accused of being gratuitous and stopping narratives in their tracks. Sex scenes typically only move the plot forward in erotic thrillers or porn. But even then, you could argue it's more like the other way around. The narrative's just there to justify the sex scenes. And unlike porn or erotic thrillers, the sex isn't designed to titillate in this film. At least, I don't think so. I mean, Cronenberg says that the purpose of horror is to provide us with a study of fear, and most people would say it's also quite simply to frighten us. Fear is just another form of titillation, at least the kind of thrills and chills that horror aficionados actively seek out. And I think that by constantly intermingling the iconography of horror with the trappings of sexuality to the point that they become indistinguishable, Cronenberg denies us any straightforward titillation, whether thrilling or sexual, in nature. It's like they cancel each other out, though I'm sure not for everyone. I'm not here to kink shame.
I feel really vulnerable. Disembodied.
Speaking of which, now Allegra is back to being coercive. He's tried to stop telling her, I'm very worried about my body. His supposedly real body outside of this game within the game, which feels very vulnerable to him. But she keeps trying to push him into having sex and eventually gets her way. Instead of that sex scene here, we're about to get a smash cut to something completely different. So we can hear in a sound bridge her kind of moaning as we cut to this factory setting. And I think that really creates this sense of continuity between these images, which is very strange, this juxtaposition between sex and physical labor. I don't think the film's trying to make any kind of statement about how sex work is work, but there's something very jarring about the abrupt transition that begs reflection. Sex in this game is just something that a player has to do in order to advance, much like labor in our actual daily lives. Which reminds me of queer theory's critiques of compulsory heteronormativity, that under capitalist heteropatriarchy, even sex must be productive. Coupling off, getting married, and having children are like checkpoints on the hetero journey of adulthood. Many people don't stop to question whether they're truly one size fits all. Do them because that's what's expected of us. It's simply what you do. And this film is definitely asking us to think about the illusion of choice within rigged systems. Paykel in particular keeps being thrust into situations that aren't at all of his own making, and in the end, his character never had a chance. But all he can do in the meantime is keep playing, and for some strange reason, that means laboring. At this point in the film, I'm always really struck by how unappealing the game world is. This trout farm really doesn't seem like the kind of life-changing escape that could cause people to utterly lose themselves in a game. And I think that's another indication that so-called reality and the game are indistinguishable in this dystopian future. The film's bleak color palette, the various shades of grays and browns, is consistent throughout. Whereas we might expect the game world to be enticing in some way, more beautiful, more colorful, more erotic, more exciting, whatever, than the so-called real world, in fact, the mise-en-scene across all levels of reality and unreality is pretty uniformly drab. Nearly every interior shot of buildings looks pretty similar. The factory here, the game store, the ski lodge, the restaurant we're going to see soon, the hall where the movie begins and ends, are all virtually indistinguishable. Paykel continuously refers to the dirtiness of the game, saying it feels unclean. And I think this is true on both a literal and metaphorical level, that is, in terms of both visual design and morality. The existence that Cronenberg imagines in Existenz is characterized by uniformity and a lack of individuality. Really a nightmare for an existentialist philosopher.
Yes?
So yeah, at this point it could be hard to understand why anyone would choose to play a game like this, but then again, most of us wake up every day and choose to continue to participate in our own exploitation. As Ursula Le Guin once said, we live in capitalism, its power seems inescapable. So did the divine right of kings. I don't want to suggest that either Cronenberg or this film is anti-capitalist. I actually don't think this film has clear politics, but I do think it's asking us to think about how we're caught up in systems that are so much bigger than us, but often manage to operate invisibly. When we do notice them, as Le Guin says, they feel inescapable, but it's all a matter of perception. This is obviously a metaphor that's taken up at length in other science fiction films like The Matrix as well. But I think this film does it in a way that is specifically about labor. This, to me, is another connection to Videodrome, which is on some level a kind of workplace drama. Max gets roped into it all because of his job, and then is tasked with killing various other people in his workplace. A fair amount of the film is focused on him just trying to do his job, and that's how one of the film's primary metaphors functions. Not for nothing, there's a cartoonish poster of Hitler on Max's wall, and the character's journey is about learning whether he's one to stay in line and follow orders, or whether he has the strength of will to oppose this group of fascists who are trying to program the public to their will. This film also often talks about the idea of programming pretty overtly. And Paykel, similarly, is a worker who's been roped into this entire adventure by his employer, even though I think we can assume that none of this stuff would be anywhere in a marketing trainee's job description. It feels like a wry commentary on the exploitation of laborers. And then when they encounter Gas, they take the time to discuss how he uses the game to escape from a life of menial labor. And now, here in the game, we get an extended detour through the world of factory labor. So this again reminds me of Adorno and Horkheimer, who talk about how film was used as a very effective propaganda tool by the Nazis. They argue that Hollywood does something similar, but it's so subtle that we all fail to notice it as such. In both cases, they deliver ideology to the public. They program us to think and ultimately to behave in ways that align with the values of the state. I think this image of people walking blindly along evokes that idea as well. For Nazis, this was in service of fascism. For Hollywood, it's in service of capitalism. I have no idea whether Cronenberg has read these theorists' work, but intentionally or not, his films do tend to reflect some of their preoccupations. And I think there's a subtle critique in that scene we just watched of how the industrial world treats other living things as commodities. We do, in fact, farm animals for raw materials for our high-tech world, and this film makes that look pretty disgusting and horrifying. It almost reminds me of Georges Franju's Blood of the Beasts. And like Blood of the Beasts and other films like Modern Times and Strike, I think that with shots like the one we just saw, where the people are walking along like livestock, the film is drawing a visual parallel between the industrial exploitation of non-human animals and the exploitation of the laborers that harvest and slaughter them. At this point, Allegra's behavior in the factory had briefly made it seem like she may somehow have become an NPC, which prompts us to consider whose perspective we've been inhabiting this whole time. And really, it's his. She's still the more dominant character, but ultimately, this is a man's story. We're positioned in relation to Allegra, just like he is, without access to her additional knowledge of the game and the story world. Since she appeared to be an NPC, and Pikel's choices are now seeming to entirely drive the story, the film calls attention to the fact that, although this may seem to be the only Cronenberg film with a female protagonist, in fact, all along we've been aligned with Pikel. Her choices drive the narrative for a lot of the film's runtime, but it's he that we tend to be asked to identify with, because like him, our knowledge of what's happening here is very limited, and we presumably share his horror, at least his hesitation at the idea of having a bioport surgically added to our bodies, or of eating this nasty fish that he's going to be eating. And we share his wonder and confusion and frustration as he encounters various aspects of the strange game world. And of course, in the end, it turns out that she isn't even the game designer.
Existence is paused!
But now she's back to seeming like a character with a lot of agency, which is just one of many ways that the film is disorienting. So Pikel has now paused the game because he says he's losing track of who he actually is, essentially losing himself in the game. He says it's like a kind of psychosis, and her response here, that this is a great sign, is profoundly disturbing. In moments like this, the film seems to have a straightforwardly anti-technology or anti-gaming or maybe specifically anti-VR message. But soon it'll pull the rug out from beneath us yet again, revealing additional layers to its philosophizing. Now that we're out of the game within the game, the borders between the realities are starting to break down. Pikel notes that the real world feels unreal, and her reply that it's safe and therefore boring is a bit strange if you think about it. We might typically think that our real lives are more boring than the lives we briefly imagine ourselves into through movies and video games and other media, but the real world certainly isn't safer than these mediated worlds, is it?
Where we are is real at all. This feels like a game to me. And you, you're beginning to feel a bit like a game character.
This is where a character within the film first acknowledges that maybe this world outside the game is not in fact reality, but possibly another virtual space. And she immediately starts using her sexuality to try to get him back into the game. I think it would be easy to accuse this film of sex negativity, actually. The body horror is so intimately, as it were, bound up with sexuality, like here, where the game pod gyrates in a disturbingly erotic fashion. I mean, when she turns it on, she turns it on. And I think it's supposed to make us uncomfortable, the way the game pod evokes kind of a uterus and also genitals, and the way that playing it involves penetration, specifically of a man. But the coercion within that scene, within the game, that we're seeing here is arguably even more horrifying and uncomfortable than the pseudo-sexual coercion involved with getting to him to install the port. I think Cronenberg is asking us to think about the normalization of violence in video games and other media, including of his own films, by, you know, having her essentially convince him that he's going to kill someone. But I think it's also asking us to question the concept of free will. I think this moment in particular evokes the long-standing debates in philosophy and neuroscience over whether intention really does dictate actions versus whether what feels like a choice to us is always an inevitable result of brain chemistry. In other words, it's possible that we confuse correlation with causation when we believe that conscious awareness creates choices and actions. These moments, when the game seems to take over the player, visualize the implications of that theory for us. That is, even those who believe that free will is an illusion tend to argue that we should not live our lives as though that is the case, because it would obviously lead to a complete lack of responsibility for our actions and a complete breakdown of morality as we know it. And existentialism insists that we must determine our own realities through acts of individual will. In this scene, it's disturbing that he seemingly can't do that.
Michael.
So initially, he must eat this disgusting meal simply because it's something his game character was born to do, as she puts it. And I don't know what it says about me, but this is easily the hardest thing in the film for me to watch.
Yeah, it's a genuine game urge. Something your game character was born to do.
But even more horrifying, at least from a moral perspective, he's now about to murder an innocent stranger against his will. Even if it's just a game, it feels real to him. And what is reality but a feeling, a perception? In any case, that's a question this film poses. And incidentally, I think this film does do a good job of mimicking the experience of a certain kind of video game play. From Peichel's perspective and ours, there are no clear objectives. He just keeps wandering around and doing things without knowing why he's doing them. And they're going to remark on this in the next scene. I think this is supposed to be intentionally frustrating, or in any case, for me as a viewer, I can say that it was frustrating on first watch. And again, this evokes existentialism by making us want the characters to take charge of their own lives in some meaningful way. If life, like the game, is meaningless unless we endow it with meaning, we can't just float along letting things happen to us.
You sure this is okay?
Yeah, it should be okay.
So we're soon going to hear the phrase again, death to the demoness, Allegra Geller. She's not amused and seems to feel afraid, as if she's no longer in control. But as a side note, I think this is yet another connection to Videodrome. Both films feature the phrase death to prominently. In this case, it's the demoness, Allegra Geller. In Videodrome, it's death to Videodrome.
Death to the demoness, Allegra Geller.
That's not funny.
sorry.
It's unclear whether he actually thought that was funny or was kind of caught up in an action of the game that he couldn't control. And now he realizes that it's the waiter he's supposed to kill, and he doesn't want to. He thinks the waiter is too nice, and just to drive the point home, the waiter's going to walk up and be super nice to them.
Well, that makes sense.
But when it comes down to it, Paykel will act without hesitation.
Waiter.
Again, as if without free will, like
waiter.
An automaton. The virtual world is really the opposite of liberating in this film. Cronenberg speaks in interviews about how the human body is the primary fact of human existence. It's life and the inevitability of death all rolled into one. He seems to see this as a kind of tragic aspect of our existence, something many of us yearn to escape from. Biology isn't destiny, or at least who we are should not be reduced to that. And yet, nor should we ignore the realities of embodied existence and the inequalities that result from them in a heteropatriarchal, ableist society.
What can I do to make your lunch more pleasant?
I found this in my soup, and I'm very upset.
This is a very Cronenbergian moment, one of his signature practical effects. And yet another connection to Videodrome, also because both films feature assassins as major plot points, and in both cases the protagonist at least briefly acts as an assassin himself, using a strange fleshy or bony gun as a weapon. And as I mentioned earlier, this bone gun here was made out of actual bone and gristle, so maybe the dog is actually enjoying it, and really fired human teeth.
It's all right. Just a little misunderstanding over the check. Pay no attention and enjoy your meal.
I feel a serious game urge to get out of here.
I love this weirdly sultry look that he gives while holding this absolutely repulsive fish creature. And now that they've killed a man who was just doing his job and who we'll soon learn was probably completely innocent, we're taken behind the scenes to see yet another kind of labor in a commercial kitchen. This character apparently has several jobs, and we'll learn that this company is vertically and horizontally integrated. They own the trout farm, the factory, the restaurant, and various other things related to game production. Here they learn they've supposedly passed a test. They seem to be getting answers to their questions, but as the film goes on, it becomes harder and harder to know what's true and what's not. Not least because everyone seems to be lying to them. And we get a big info dump in this scene. Some of it's really worth kind of digging into.
These are the breeding pools. Breeding pools.
Is this where you caught today's special?
We originally were raising these mutant creatures for the nervous systems for game pods, but then we found they could be quite tasty. And so we opened a restaurant, which now that is uncovered.
But of course, we are also raising them as components for undetectable and hypoallergenic weapons.
Right. This is another ridiculous accent, of course, but also this reminds me of Spectacular Optical in Videodrome. Barry Convex explains that company creates inexpensive glasses for people in the third world and also high-tech weapons for NATO. I think in both cases, there's a vague commentary on the ways that the war machine is funded by corporations and industries that are better known for creating media or consumer goods or whatever.
We love you.
Now that you have proven to be true and trustworthy realists.
So we've been introduced, finally, to the idea of the realists, the underground activists. Splink and you'll miss it, but I love this hit-by-a-car simulation game with a person looking ecstatic about being hit by a car. This could be a vague allusion to Crash, which was released a few years earlier in 1996, but it also feels like a critique of the ways that we unwittingly destroy ourselves by losing hours of our lives to media. At least that's one way of looking at it. And in so doing, we exult in our own destruction. So maybe this is an indictment of games in particular, but I think the critique can be extended to anything that is designed primarily as an escape from reality. Because, at least especially from an existentialist perspective, in escaping reality, we lose ourselves. I think it's also relevant because the guy on the package is like the game itself. It becomes clear around this point that the goal of the game is apparently to destroy the factory and all game systems within it, because they are the enemy of reality. This is a really bizarre game objective, if you think about it. It's very self-reflexive, of course, but it's essentially like the game wants to commit suicide.
We were contacted there by Yevgeny Nur. She seemed to know exactly who we were.
And now we're learning that Yevgeny was apparently a double agent, and the waiter was not supposed to be Pykel's target, but rather his contact. And basically, it's just impossible to know what to believe.
If Nourish isn't our real contact, who is he?
Nourish is a double agent for Cortical System X. He was working with Nader to subvert the realist cause, and doing it rather well. After all, he got you to assassinate your own contact. But now you're going to put a stop to him.
I don't want to be here.
Come on, Pykel. We just got a bad case of first-time user anxiety.
I don't like it here. I don't know what's going on. We're both stumbling around together in this unformed world whose rules and objectives are largely unknown, seemingly indecipherable, or even possibly non-existent, always on the verge of being killed by forces that we don't understand.
That sounds like my game, all right.
It sounds like a game. It's not going to be easy to market.
But it's a game.
So that line, you know, it's clearly what they're talking about is a metaphor for the existential terror of existence. It's a bit on the nose, and critics at the time pointed to moments like this as examples for how the film is really forcing the existentialist metaphor. But I think it's also tapping into the many ways that we are alienated from each other and ourselves under late capitalism. Most of us have jobs that aren't necessary in any meaningful sense. Many jobs are about making products that people don't need, convincing people that they do need them, delivering those products, or in the extremes of high finance and things like that, it's literally just about making money from other people's money. I've been talking about the ways that this film asks us to consider media's complicity in all of this. We're susceptible to the lure of escapism because our real lives can feel so meaningless and our efforts at improving them can feel so futile. We are, in fact, wandering around aimlessly with objectives unknown much of the time. And it's a vicious cycle. So, as in Videodrome, Cronenberg is also critiquing our ever-expanding dependency on technology. He foresees a future in which human beings increasingly avoid direct or physical contact with each other. That is, a future in which individuals travel alone on the journey of life. This game is designed to replace our mundane realities, and in so doing, it creates a false sense of meaning. I think this is one of the most prescient aspects of this film. Although virtual reality is in no way the primary culprit in our increasing alienation from each other and ourselves, that's probably social media, it's nonetheless a very real phenomenon today. how often do any of us interact socially with others IRL versus online? This is another moment when the film equates sex with death. When he plugs this diseased pod into her, she seems to be orgasming and dying simultaneously. So you might say that the film is equating le petit moi, or the little death, with capital D death, which again could be seen as reflecting an attitude of sex negativity. Because the subtext has really become text here. It's as if STDs and computer viruses are merging into a single threat. This fear of high-tech infection that briefly takes over the narrative would be taken up by Cronenberg's son, Brandon, in interesting new ways and in more depth in the 2012 film Antiviral. Here it's just a detour, whereas there it's the film's central metaphor and primary plot engine, but in both cases, there's the idea of corporations selling us the means of our own destruction, exploiting our death drive, as Freud might say. And now, a lot really happens all at once, and it's a bit overwhelming.
Michael, I'm bleeding to death.
We've got the severing of the umbilical cord, which is certainly a metaphor, and now we're about to get a flamethrower triggering deadly spores to rain down on them. And I think spores are a really interesting choice for the infection because of the ways that mushrooms are associated with death and decay and neural networks, and also some kinds, like psilocybin, allow us to see the world in new ways if we ingest them, which I think is pretty beautiful personally, but I suppose one could describe this game experience as a bad trip.
Sports. Deadly sports.
In any case, before Norrish dies here, he manages to begin to repeat the line, "Death to the demoness Allegra Geller." But he's cut short, and indeed the game world seems to be short-circuiting.
I think we just lost the game.
As the two realities seem to be bleeding into each other.
Or maybe not.
Soon, yet another layer of reality will be revealed to us, and we'll realize that the characters all look like and have the same names as the people playing them. So this is another thing that makes me really wonder why anyone would choose to play a game like this. It's not just that the game world is bleak, it's that there are no options for escaping our fleshy prisons in any meaningful sense. They're still entirely limited by their real world embodiment, in other words, when they could be trying on new bodies, new genders, new sexualities. At the same time as the VR boom was happening in 1990s sci-fi, feminist theorists were exploring the idea of cyberspace as a site of freedom and gender indeterminacy. They saw it as a potentially revolutionary space in which one could take on any number of roles and explore any number of desires that were repressed in our daily lives. In other words, it's a space where we could construct personal realities that are free from the determination of our real body-based identities. And theorists like Donna Haraway wanted to break down the binary between the natural and the technological. She used the cyborg as a metaphor to envision technology as potentially empowering. Rather than being limited by the bodies we're born with, we could exceed them, but only if we're able to break free from the systems like capitalism that control the uses of tech. This is a pretty stark contrast to the largely dystopian cinematic representations of cyberspace, for which this film is no exception. There's no suggestion here that it could be particularly liberating to be able to play around with sex or gender. The film obliquely acknowledges the possibilities for trying on new roles. We do see men being penetrated, after all, and a woman taking on the role of the game designer, who in real life we learn is a man. But there's no utopian cyborg to be found here. Cronenberg also wants to break down the binary between the natural and the technological, but here and elsewhere in his filmography, merging of body and technology is at best uncomfortably erotic and at worst straight up grotesque. In the end, Cronenberg seems to be more concerned with the ways that our technologies constrain and imprison us. Feminist theory did eventually come around as well to the fact that technologies created by humans will contain within them human biases. So more often than not, our technologies wind up replicating and exacerbating rather than freeing us from existing social norms, hierarchies, and forms of oppression. And I think on some level, this film shrewdly acknowledges that by showing us that the virtual realm is not a viable alternative to our embodied realities.
Is an agent for
oh
the
god.
It would be easy to think of him as a Luddite, but I don't think it's so simple. Cronenberg has said in interviews that technology is us. There is no separation. It's a pure expression of human creative will, which sounds very existentialist. And if it is at times dangerous and threatening, it's because we have within ourselves things that are dangerous, self-destructive, and threatening. So basically, technologies are not morally or ideologically neutral, but nor are they inherently bad. They're created by humans with drives and biases, and those things are built into them.
That rotting piece of meat here has done its job!
I keep my game inside there! I can't let my game die! No! Wait! Ah!
This is where Paykel is going to articulate what we've probably been suspecting for some time now.
Listen to me! I think we're still inside the game. I think your pod's out there somewhere, somewhere safe. I think it's all right to let go of this one. This pod, it's not the real...
We don't yet know for sure whether he's right, but I think his articulation of it makes a lot of things click into place.
This way! Come on!
We learn in this scene that these activists or terrorists, honestly, it's all a matter of semantics, depending on whether your own beliefs align with their ideologies. We learn that they're fighting on behalf of realism. Some people have speculated that the realist underground is a metaphor for Cronenberg's critics because his preferred aesthetic is not generally what we might describe as realist. But honestly, I don't think we can make a compelling case that this film is advocating for the opposite ideology, which in this case would be to expand VR technologies or celebrate media escapism more broadly. That said, one thing I love about Cronenberg films is that they tend to embrace complexities and contradictions rather than trying to make clear black and white statements. So I think it can actually be both, that these activists, terrorists, represent his critics and also represent, you know, one of the main ideas that this film is kind of advocating. Again, as in Videodrome, these activists are depicted as overall preferable in some sense to the larger systems that they're fighting against, even as they're also misguided zealots whose violent actions are of questionable utility. And here I'm not talking about just these ones within the game, but also, you know, we'll see that there are realists in the real world driving this aspect of the game's narrative.
You murdered my game!
No! I murdered your pod! Your game is healthy and happy!
No.
I replicated your pod's entire nervous system during our little surgical procedure at the chalet. Complete with...
So now industrial espionage is introduced to the plot on top of the activist uprising. He's holding her game hostage so that she'll join up with the corporation that's opposed to the realists. Contemporary critics took issue with these scenes here, where we suddenly get twist upon twist, arguing that they're needlessly confusing. It is a bit dizzying, but the film acknowledges and pokes fun of that in the final scene when a character critiques the gameplay by saying that the twists and turns at the end made my head spin. After all, if Cronenberg is ambivalent about his own role as a creator of escapist films, albeit more philosophical and thought-provoking than the average Hollywood film, then these twists and turns serve an ideological purpose. We're not supposed to get lost in the story in a pleasurable sense. We're supposed to be hyper-aware at various points of the fact that we're in a story of someone else's construction, that we are, in fact, being programmed, playing someone else's game. What is the filmmaker's responsibility as creator, but also what is our own responsibility as viewers? This dialogue begs that very question.
I didn't like the way it was messing with my mind.
You didn't like that, so you killed him.
He's only a game character.
Allegra. What if we're not in the game anymore?
Basically, the film is asking us to think about the consequences of virtual or mediated actions, suggesting that they shouldn't be dismissed as merely play. Is it ever really just a game or just a movie? Art changes the way that people think. It's not always a direct or linear one-to-one relationship between what we see and what we believe afterwards, but we can't just mindlessly consume, or else we're complicit in our own destruction. We must take charge of our own fates, whether that means thinking critically about what we watch, as I'm trying to do right now, incidentally, or simply turning it off and living our lives. This is also where we seem to learn that, even within what had seemed like the real world, Allegra was never really calling the shots.
And understand this. Understand I knew that you were my
but
real assassin.
But here we get yet another twist.
In the Chinese restaurant. And understand that you're dead.
So we get yet another repetition of this phrase, this time with variation. And it, to me, gets me thinking about the fact that demoness is a strange word to begin with. Even if after several times of hearing it, we might get used to it. But when she degenders it here, I think that calls attention to the fact that it was gendered female in the first place. People could have referred to her just as easily as a demon all along, but the fact that they insisted on calling her a demoness means the word took on a gendered connotation, almost as if they're calling her a bitch, which is part of why I think the film prefigures Gamergate in some small sense. The realists clearly are genuinely opposed to the idea of video games, or at least VR, so in that sense, this isn't about her, but realism and misogyny aren't mutually exclusive. Maybe they also felt extra fired up to take her down because she's a successful woman game designer.
Are you all back?
In any case, as we're about to realize, the real designer, maybe, if this is real life, is a man.
I have a feeling some of our crew doesn't realize it yet.
So now we're finally maybe in the real world, but we never know for sure. It could have been a game within a game within yet another game. I have a term for the analogous phenomenon of a dream within a dream within a dream that occasionally pops up in other narratives. I like to call it a mise en a dream. I'm not sure if that's a term I coined or if other people use it as well, but in any case, it's a play on the term mise en abyme, which refers to a formal technique within the visual arts of repeatedly placing a copy of an image within itself over and over again, or, you know, in the narrative arts, could be a story within a story, usually in a way that suggests an infinitely recurring sequence. And here we might call it a mise en a game. You guys were great. In any case, there's a lot to unpack in this final sequence. It's interesting how everything is almost the same as in the game world, but not quite. The game systems appear to be a kind of biotech, but here the headsets look bony rather than fleshy. The characters have different accents, which don't sound fake anymore, and different roles, but it's more like the roles have been traded rather than swapped out for something completely new. These people have the same names as their characters. They look the same. So, in other words, you know, they're played by the same actors, but styled differently and with different personalities. Most of them are just ordinary people, and it turns out that Allegra is not the game designer. And it turns out the game they were all playing is Transcendence. Transcendence is an important word for existentialists as well. Jean-Paul Sartre uses transcendence to describe the relation of the self to the object-oriented world, as well as our concrete relations with others. He contrasts it with immanence, where immanence is actuality, finite physical existence, and transcendence is a state of existence beyond or outside of physical existence. And importantly, transcendence is also seeing the other as a being that exists separate from one's own consciousness. It's necessary for self-actualization. So transcendence, the game, is in some ways the opposite of transcendence. Whereas it does involve a state of existence beyond the physical, it's not one that allows us to meaningfully recognize or reflect on our own existence or anyone else's. Instead, it's an illusory facsimile of the real.
Very disturbed by the game we just played.
What do you mean?
It had a very strong, very real anti-game theme. I mean, it began with the attempted assassination of a game designer.
Really? That's very creative. On second thought, I see what you mean. It does make me nervous. You think this must have come from one of our game players?
The fact that this scares him suggests that he knows on some level that this is more than just a game, that there are consequences to developing technologies like this.
Thank you.
Now, Sartre believes that individuals must seek sincerity and authenticity in order to avoid bad faith, stagnancy, and lying to oneself. What makes virtual reality so dangerous from that perspective is that it's the ultimate practice of bad faith, because it's the most convincing yet insincere representation of our minds, the world of our reality.
As long as you don't ask me to fill in your questionnaires. We've played your game now, so we can finally agree with the others that you are indeed the world's greatest game artist. We weren't sure before. Oh, thanks so much.
New Guinea? Don't you think you should have to suffer for all the harm you've done and intend to do to the human race?
What? Yes. Don't you think the world's greatest game artist ought to be punished for the most effective deforming of reality?
In the end, it remains unclear whose side we're supposed to be on. The film's dizzying twists with realities bleeding into each other certainly make the realist's concerns seem valid, even though they're disturbingly violent. Because we as viewers can't tell reality from the game any more than the participants can.
Death to the demon, Yevgeny Narash!
Death to Piltimash!
So we get yet another series of death to lines here, ending with death to transcendence, which is even closer to Videodrome's version of the line. In both cases, it's not a person who needs to be eradicated. Not really. It's a company, a system, a concept, much more than an individual, though these things are deeply threatening to individuals and to collectives.
No, you don't have to shoot me! Hey, tell me the truth, are we still in a game?
There's no answer to that question, and we are left to wonder, did we ever see reality outside of the game? What is reality? Is perception so inherently subjective that it's impossible to access any such thing as objective reality, to the point that objective reality is not a thing that exists? And more disturbingly, I don't think we have any idea how we're supposed to feel about what they've done one way or another. Regardless, the sense of unease that we're left with due to the lack of real closure ideally leads us to ponder the meaning of what we've watched. In other words, to be the kind of responsible, active spectators that wouldn't mindlessly lose themselves in the media that they consume. Well, I hope you enjoyed this commentary, and thank you for listening.